thanks so much for speaking to us here at Commonweal, Marie Collins. As I was preparing for this interview, I got to thinking about the remit, the papal order that created the commission that you served on. And so I saw that, as the announcement said, your role on the commission was to recommend policy changes to the Vatican. But I went a little further into it, and I saw that it gave you really a mandate from the Pope to review the internal operations of some of the Vatican dicasteries, the Vatican congregations and agencies that were relevant to this question of sexual abuse in the clergy. And I was wondering, you know, as one lay person to another, what was that like to be able to delve into how well they were doing their job inside the Vatican?
It would have been very interesting. It would have been very helpful to the commission to be able to look at how the different dicasteries had been dealing with the different aspects of the abuse problem. But unfortunately, there was resistance to that in the actual Curia departments. We wanted to talk to them about what procedures they had in place, how they found them, were they working, were they having problems. We wanted to put to them some of our ideas, see what they thought of them, could they improve on them, had they any ideas of their own, back and forth. And they would not come and talk to us, which was a great shame. So for 18 months, nearly 2 years, the different departments, they would not come and talk to the commission. So we went ahead with our work, of course, but without being able to look into the practices that were already in place to learn from them or to learn if what their weaknesses were or their strengths.
What would you have liked to find out about?
Well, for example, we were writing a guidelines template, which was in order that our idea was that we would circulate it when it was completed to all the episcopal conferences around the world, and they could use it as a basis for drawing up their safeguarding policies. They would be requested to incorporate the measures that were in this template, which was best practice, as per the experts on the commission. And we wanted to talk to the CDF, because they had a lot of policies which had been sent in from the episcopal conferences. And we wanted to see what those documents were like, what their weaknesses were, what their strengths were they up to the standard that we were actually going to recommend. And they wouldn't allow us to see them. They said they were confidential. And I found that quite staggering, because we were a pontifical commission there to advise the Pope. And they were a department in the Vatican also working in the administration for the Pope. But they wouldn't talk to us, and they wouldn't let us see what standards they had already got in place, which they were holding the various guidelines that were sent in up against. So we were sort of in the dark as to what was there already, and we just had to work away on our own. So that was a great problem. It left us lacking a certain input, which would have been very useful and positive to have as part of the mix. I think the reason was, and I know the reason was, that some of these dicasteries felt that we were outsiders coming in to interfere, and we were lay people, and the attitude was sort of, we've been doing this for years, we know how to do it, how dare you come in and tell us how we should be doing it. So it was a very negative attitude, and it didn't help the work of the commission at all, and I found that very hard.
So the commission did come up with recommendations to Pope Francis, I guess, to create a tribunal that would be able to review the actions of bishops who may have, you know, concealed the wrongdoing.
Yeah, because at the time there was no really clear process in place. So we worked on an accountability tribunal, which we felt should be central in the Vatican. It would hold bishops accountable who are negligent or who had covered up or who had protected abusers, that they would be judged by this central tribunal and there would be investigations and sanctions. We put this proposal to the Holy Father and he accepted it. He announced on the 10th of June 2015 that this was going to happen. The C9, in fact, announced the Pope had approved it. He was to give all the financial support necessary, and he was to give all the personnel support necessary, and he was to put it into the hands of the CDF, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, to actually implement.
And its response was, well, we already have been doing something like this, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. A few months later, we heard that they were not going to implement it. And I discovered later when the prefect of the CDF, Cardinal Muller, spoke after my resignation, he said that they decided not to implement it because they had all the process they needed in place, which in fact was not correct, because the Pope brought out his, as a loving mother, to replace the tribunal, the motu proprio.
Right, the document from 2016.
That's right.
That set up a process for judging bishops that spread the authority around to four other different Vatican offices, I would say probably mainly the Congregation for Bishops.
That's right.
And to specifically take away jurisdiction from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the CDF.
That's right. The Accountability Tribunal recommendation had gone in 2015. The Pope's motu proprio came out in 1916. And it took the accountability process out of the hands of the CDF, and it put it primarily in the hands of the Congregation for the Bishops, which I personally do not feel was a good idea, because it's very difficult for colleagues to judge colleagues in any institution. So that, I felt, was a weakness in that policy. I met the Pope in August last year, and he said it was in operation and he was holding bishops accountable. And when he found they were guilty, he removed them. But the problem is that we're not seeing this in a transparent manner. We don't know how it's working, who's doing the judging, etc.
Yeah, I guess that's the big question, is the structure set up in 2016. It's been a few years now. How do we assess it?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what's happening. I mean, when I spoke to the Holy Father in August, I asked about the tribunal, and he had changed his mind, and he had now got the motu proprio, obviously because the CDF wouldn't work the tribunal. But he was now saying that he felt bishops couldn't be judged by the same standard. They had to be judged by different standards depending on what culture they were in. And he was talking about there being judgments at local level.
By whom?
And that,
by
he said on the plane returning to Rome that he would explain it to me next time he saw me. But I think everyone needs an explanation as to exactly what is going on. Where are the judges? Who are the judges? And who has been found guilty? Nobody is. Bishops are being allowed to just resign and walk away. And if they've been found guilty of negligence, that should be known. It's a deterrent to others, you know?
Right. Now, I have that quote from Pope Francis in front of me, from where he spoke to the press on the way home from Ireland in August. And he said, "I said this to Marie, the spirit and the recommendation of as a loving mother are being put into effect.
Yeah.
A bishop must be judged by a tribunal, but not always the same tribunal, because that is not possible." She doesn't understand this entirely, but when I see her, because she comes to the Vatican sometimes, we call her, I will explain it to her more clearly. And one more thing, he says, "I like her." So I'm wondering about your connection with Pope Francis, what that's been like, but did he ever explain this to you more fully?
No, I haven't seen him since. And I think, you know, when we did converse and have conversed, I sort of speak straight to the point. And I think he's a man that likes that. So that probably goes in my favor. No, I haven't had an explanation. But I think, as I say, I think the entire laity, as well as everyone in the church, needs to have this process explained. Because if people don't know the process or the mechanics of this accountability tribunal, they don't see it happening, they're going to perceive that it doesn't exist. And I think that's the problem at the moment. You know, we don't know how it's being done or where it's being done. And I would like to see the meeting coming up next month, it being explained very clearly to the participants, and they being told very clearly that it's how it's being implemented, and that they will be subject to it, and all their fellow bishops, and for it also to be made public so that everyone knows what is actually happening and how is it happening, and are bishops being held accountable and how.
So the meeting the Pope has called on the protection of minors, inviting many bishops from all over the world to the Vatican, I believe February 21st to 24th.
That's right, yeah.
And on your website, mariecollins.net, you've posted your suggestions for this meeting. And there's one thing that's a little off the beaten path, but one thing that really jumped out at me was this proposal: review canon law on the abuse of vulnerable adults, separating it from the abuse of minors. And I think that that part of it often goes by the wayside, that adults, both women and men, have suffered abuse in quite a few instances from clergy. If there's not such a good mechanism for cases with minors, it seems there's even less for dealing with these cases with adults.
Well, there's even less. I think the two, you know, they should not be confused. And canon law that's there at the moment, it's vague enough about minors. You know, it speaks about delicts against the sixth decalogue, you know, against the sixth commandment. And it talks about minors, and it defines vulnerable adults as those who have a problem with their mental faculties. You know, they maybe have not reached the adulthood in mental faculties, and that is one thing. But the problem is that that is not the entire definition of vulnerable adults. A vulnerable adult can be vulnerable due to the fact that there's a differential in power between themselves and their abuser. Or they can be somebody who, say, has been going for counseling to a priest. They've had a marriage breakdown, or they've had a severe illness, or they're suicidal. For whatever reason, they may be in a very emotional, very depressed state. And they are very vulnerable to somebody taking advantage of them. Young seminarians and young nuns, they can be very much exploited by somebody who has in authority, who has a great deal of power over them. So a vulnerable adult is not somebody that is permanently vulnerable, like somebody who have mental faculty problems, but they can be vulnerable at a certain time in their lives. They're not permanently vulnerable. But that has to be really taken into account. And the way you deal with it, the way you keep those people safe, and the way you deal with anyone who would exploit them, it's got to be different in the way you would handle a case of a minor, someone under the age of 18. It's an abuse, but it's a different category of abuse. And it really, in my mind, needs to be dealt with quite separately. We've seen it in America, you know, the McCarrick case. We've seen nuns now coming forward. And I do believe this is going to grow massively for the church in the future.
Allegations against Cardinal McCarrick have certainly echoed throughout the church, but do you think that Cardinal McCarrick's case concerning his alleged involvement with seminarians, do you think that's going to maybe lead to some change in terms of this question of abuse of adults?
I hope it does, because it's not that the problem hasn't existed, but it has brought it into the spotlight. And the nuns are beginning to come forward. I mean, it was said, you know, it only applies really to nuns in Africa. Everyone will say, oh, young nuns in Africa can be exploited by priests. But actually, it's happening just as much in America or anywhere else. And I think with the Me Too movement particularly, nuns now are going to feel they can come forward. As in the past, when victims at first couldn't come forward because of the taboo, and because they didn't think they'd be believed, I think it's going to be easier for those who were exploited or abused, sexually abused as vulnerable adults. They will find it a little easier now to come forward, I think. And I do believe it's a very big problem in the church that has been ignored because it hasn't been in the public eye. And with everything that has happened in the church, it's not until it comes into the public eye that the church starts to pay attention to it. They tend with this whole issue to be reactive rather than proactive.
Yeah.
They look at countries where there's a big crisis arises and then they do a lot. But in the countries where we know the same thing is happening, but it hasn't reached the media, they're very complacent.
Right. There's been so much debate on the causes of the clergy's sexual abuse crisis scandal, mostly along ideological lines, whether it's because of the clerical culture or the sexual orientation of priests or celibacy or secrecy. But, you know, setting aside that whole debate, what kind of best practices are there, concrete practical steps that have been shown to work?
Well, certainly, I think, or my view for a start is that I think people don't go into the church and then become abusers because of the church. I think people who are inclined to abuse go into all sorts of areas like teaching and sports coaches and scout leaders because it will facilitate their abuse. And I think that can happen with people going into the church. The first thing that can be done, obviously, is proper psychological evaluation of those entering seminaries in formation. There are a lot of red flags that the experts can see in people, even people who may not know at the time that they have this inclination, but that there's the possibility of it there. Proper psychological evaluation right through formation. And human formation needs to be looked at very closely in the seminaries as well. But I think that area has to be looked at very, very closely. And then obviously you have to have the safeguarding practices. I know some priests sort of push against safeguarding practices. I've seen it here in Ireland where they resent them. They feel that it's picking them out to look as though they can't be trusted, you know?
You mean like as I was a college teacher, but you would always leave your door open. That's just practice.
Yeah, exactly. Practice. Yeah. I was a scout leader and at one time, and you couldn't go and talk to a child in a room on your own. You had to leave the door open. If a child was sick at a meeting or something, you couldn't take them home in your car on your own. And I think what sometimes all of us miss in this is it's there to protect the child, a rule like that, but it also protects you. Because if you follow all the rules carefully, you're protected from any sort of false accusations. So it's just as much a protection for the adult as it is for the child. And there should be no real resentment about it once the accepted practices are in place. It also means then that anyone who's not following the practice can be easily spotted by their colleagues and other people if they see them not following these safeguarding practices. And that, again, raises an issue and people begin to look more closely at it to ensure that the child is safe.
You know, we've been told a number of times now to have low expectations, but I'm wondering what specific steps you'd like to see emerge from the Protection of Minors meeting.
Well, I had hoped we would see more. I mean, from what the Pope said the other day, he said, before you have protocols and safeguarding procedures, you have to have awareness. And that's what this meeting, he said, is intended to do. It's make the bishops from around the world aware that abuse exists and what it is. It's appalling, really, to think that the church is saying they're going to do this now. I mean, where have they been for the last two decades? It's a little like Groundhog Day for me. I mean, in 2012, there was a symposium in the Gregorian in Rome. It was backed very, very much so by the Vatican. It went on for 3 days. There were bishops from 110 ecclesiastical conferences. There was 30 religious leaders from religious congregations. It was addressed by experts in every aspect of abuse, those who looked after perpetrators, those who dealt with survivors. I spoke as a survivor. And I was there, and they had workshops in different languages for the bishops. They had question times. They had discussions. Mm-hmm. And we had Liturgy of Repentance. Cardinal Wellett led that. Cardinal Levada at the time was the prefect of the CDF, and he opened the symposium. Pope Benedict sent an apostolic blessing to everyone participating, and he sent a message. It's an absolute carbon copy of what is happening now in February. And that was 7 years ago. So this is not a new move. They've done it before, and that's what disappoints me. We need education and we need awareness, but we need proper safeguarding in a parallel fashion. I suppose what I would like to see, as I said, is I'd like to see proper safeguarding standards universally across the church, rather than having one bishop doing one thing and another bishop doing something else. I think we have to have universal standards. There are international standards for the rights of the child, safety of the child, and the welfare of the child. The church has universal doctrine. It has universal canon laws. I don't see why it can't have universal safeguarding policies. That's what I would like to see. And I would like to see the bishops not only coming out at the end of this conference and saying, okay, we know now what should be done. I want to see them coming out, having given a formal commitment to do what should be done, to actually implement proper safeguarding in all their areas.
In fact, there was a UN agency that was raising questions about this whole area for the Vatican, if I remember right.
Well, the Holy See has signed up to the rights of the child, but they contend, the Holy See contends, that it only applies, obviously because it's the Holy See, it only applies to the Vatican City. It doesn't apply to the rest of the world other than nuncios, because they're citizens of the Vatican. But you only need to look at something there, which actually is an indicative of how this whole issue has been handled by the church.
It is, because we wouldn't apply that to climate change or something like that.
No, you wouldn't. No. But, I mean, just an aside on that is that Vatican City itself has not yet put in place safeguarding policy. They say they're working on it. In 2019, they're working on it. They have a junior seminary there. They have young people, families with children. They have thousands and thousands of children passing through Vatican City every day, but they have not yet put a safeguarding policy in place. I do not know how the church can stand over that. I just cannot get my head around it in 2019. It's beyond belief.
It seems kind of discouraging, I guess, for a lot of people, which leads me to wonder about your relationship to the church.
My own relationship, I mean, I'm a lifelong Catholic. I still have my faith. I still believe in the tenets of the church. I do have difficulty practicing my religion. Some of that goes back to the fact that I'm a survivor, and that has left me with various problems. I find it very difficult to be a Catholic, as many of us do nowadays. I see priests on the ground in parishes doing excellent work, wonderful work. But as you go up the chain of command, if you like, the higher you get in the church, when you get to the hierarchy and the actual institution, it's very hard to have respect and trust at that level. And I think that's where a lot of disillusionment is, and my own disillusionment is. I went to my own archbishop at the time I was trying to bring my abuser to court in 1997, and my archbishop protected him, wouldn't cooperate with the police, etc. The normal story. But it was very disillusioning to find that someone at that level would take the side of the abuser. And that is, I think, why people are very disillusioned, because at a much bigger, broader level, this way of handling things has disillusioned a lot of people. I hold on to my religion, but, you know, I sort of feel, I say to myself, well, why should I leave? Why should I have to leave? I have been working to try and improve things in the church. I haven't been working to bring it down. You know, I want a church that I can be proud of. I'm not proud of it at the moment.
That disillusion certainly seems to be having an impact in Ireland.
It has had a big impact. I mean, here, Ireland was one of the most Catholic countries in the world, you could say. We had a sort of 95% of the population were Catholic. There probably would have been a falling over off in sort of more secularization coming in over the last 20 or 30 years under normal circumstances. But the abuse crisis has absolutely decimated the Catholic Church here. I mean, the whole turnaround in society. People have walked away in droves, and our seminaries used to be full. We'd have a couple of hundred seminarians every year in the seminary, and now you might get, I think there was six last year. And of course, our priests are getting older. There are many parishes now where they used to have two or three priests. They maybe have one, or they have one trying to cover two or three parishes. And we've seen the change in the population. You know, the referendums we had soon. We just approved abortion and the gay rights. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not giving my position on the marriage rights of gay people. I'm just saying that they're indicative of how the country has changed dramatically. And the thing was, when the bishops came out, particularly when they came out to try and speak on the abortion issue, people just turned around and said, you've no moral authority to speak on anything. How dare you speak and tell us what we should do when you can't do the right thing yourselves? The bishops were left actually in speechless. In reality, they couldn't really come and make many speeches or talk or put the Catholic side of things. It's an enormous change in the country. It's absolutely enormous. And I think that's what the church need to look at, because they are very happy with how everything is exploding and expanding in the third world in the church. You know, these countries are in many ways just a few years behind the countries where the problems have been, and they will come there in time, and they have to deal with that. They have to see it coming. As I say, be proactive rather than reactive to everything, and drop the defensiveness, the blaming victims for the problem, blaming the media for having an anti-church agenda, etc. It's a real problem, and it has to be recognized as a real problem. And it's a turning point for the church. I think this meeting next month will be a crossroads. If they take the wrong turn, they'll be walking off a cliff, you know, because so many people have so much hope pinned on it. Catholics, I mean, laity. And if it looks as though they're still just talking and not taking the right actions, they are going to disappoint and disillusion a lot of people for the last time.
You know, you have an interesting relationship with Pope Francis in that you seem to disagree publicly, but in kind of a friendly way with, you know, mutual respect, I would say. Not too many people, lay people, get to know a pope in that way. So no. What is that like?
It's quite extraordinary, really. I mean, I learned a little about him when I was writing a letter to him while I was on the commission. I was writing him a letter, and then CEO here in Ireland advised me on the writing of the letter. And he said, he told me to be factual, straightforward, and not to be overly obsequious, you know, or reverential. The Pope didn't like that. And, you know, I think, and in person, I think he's the same, you know. If you have a point to make, he respects the fact you have a point to make. I may not agree with what he has to say. I ask him something and I may get an answer that I don't agree with, but he will listen to what I have to say and I will listen to what he has to say. And I think that is respect on both sides. You can disagree with someone without having to have a negative interaction or relationship, you know. I'm not claiming to be a close friend of the Pope's. I've only met him a few times. I've only had the opportunity to speak on a couple of occasions. But it is, I think something as a lay person that I wouldn't have really grasped internally is that, you know, he's a human being as well as Pope. That becomes somehow more obvious to you. It sounds like a silly thing to say, but when you're speaking to him, you know, particularly Pope Francis, he's very down to earth, and he doesn't have any what you would call airs and graces, and he wants to speak on the same level as the people he's speaking to. He doesn't put on any, and particularly when he's talking to survivors, he's not patronizing or in any way speaking, you know, from that lofty perch. He wants to listen. If he doesn't understand what's being said, he'll ask for an explanation. He will express his views. He'll show his emotions. I may not agree, as I say, with the way he's doing some things and on specific things like accountability, but I do think he's a good man, mm-hmm. you know, and that's right. The best I can say. You know, I have my problems mm-hmm. with the church. I have my problems with the institution, and I'd like to see a lot of change, but a lot of problems in the church are with people who are corrupted by power, and the power takes over when they get very high in the church. I think this is something you cannot accuse the Pope of. I don't think he is someone who is in that category at all. He's a very down-to-earth man, you know.
There are some who really lay it on him pretty harshly, but I guess that goes with the territory.
It's a very obvious fact that there are factions in the church, both in the Vatican and outside, who are very anti-Francis. I mean, they're the anti-Francis and the pro-Francis factions. And I'm not sure if some of the resistance to the commission at my time was not due to the fact that it was a Francis initiative, and so resisting it was resisting him. There's a lot of politics in the Vatican. The actual issue of the protection of children came a long way down the line from the politics. And it's the same with the anti and pro Francis, you know, and I've never got into any of that, because it's actually a pity to see the church leadership really tearing itself apart with these internal wars, when we want to see them dealing with real problems, and particularly problems of children being harmed and their lives being destroyed. Many years of my life were destroyed, the reason I campaign so hard is because I don't want to see one child being abused that could be saved from it. Can't do anything about the past. I can't change what happened to me, but if you can get through to some of these people who feel that it's all an exaggeration, or it's, you know, it's not as bad as it seems, et cetera, then it's worthwhile just keeping going. But I would like to see this meeting in February dealing with the awareness and education, no harm in that, but also getting these principals to sit down and commit to safeguarding now, not 5 years' time or 10 years' time, now. And also having them be told in very clear terms what will happen if they don't.
Ah, yeah. Well, can we look forward? I know on your website, mariecollins.net, you occasionally update with what you're doing. And can we look forward to seeing some observations on this meeting after it's concluded?
I will. A number of people have asked me if I'm going to be in Rome at the time, and I won't be, but I'll certainly be watching it very closely from afar. And if I have anything to say, I will certainly be putting it up on my website. It's I don't use it unless I have something to say, but I do have something to say.
I think so.
Many things. I put up the submission. I put up the submission I'd made to the commission, and I'll certainly be putting up any comments over the time of the meeting, because I'm not hopeful, but I hope, you know, but it would be great to be surprised and in a positive way. So let's hope. That's all we can do.
Well, thank you very much, Marie Collins. Thank you for speaking to us at Commonweal, and thanks for all you've done.
Not at all, Paul.